Welcome back to Dad's on the Air this first day of June, first day of winter in 2010. So it's a pinch and a punch for everyone on this fairly pleasant day in Sydney. It's not too cold, a little bit cloudy.
Pinch and a punch, I don't know if you're allowed to do that anymore. Bill, I think that's assault in today's world. I don't think we're allowed a pinch and punch anymore. It's a virtual pinch and a virtual punch for the virtual beginning of the virtual month, perhaps.
Let me add, it's only between consenting adults. But
yes, I don't know. I got one this morning from my seven-year-old.
Did you sign a release form, a contract of consent? And
We didn't.
Has your barrister been informed of the possible ramifications in court?
No, it was basically within 30 seconds of opening up my eyes, I was pinched and punched.
Well, we're off to a flying start this morning. So it's Bill Cable from Mediate Now, and with me in the studio is Ian Purdy from ianpurdy.com.
Yes, good morning, Bill. Good morning, everybody, and good morning, Phil, too.
And we've got Phil York from Dad's in Distress.
A very good morning to everyone.
Well, we've got a lot happening in today's show. We're hoping to catch up with our blog from Ken Thompson, who's busy cycling around Europe. And then later on, we have a real scoop. We'll be speaking with Maggie Hamilton, who has a new book out called What's Happening to Our Boys. And this is one of her first interviews. I know she's speaking at Parliament House, I think, tomorrow night, and then she's speaking at North Sydney Library on Thursday. So she's got a busy couple of days, and looks like we're getting in first. So we're looking forward to talking to Maggie. Now, there's been a lot happening this week in the news. One item in particular I know has got Ian fired up. So what have you got for us, Ian?
Well, yesterday's Daily Telegraph, I mean, front page, that's pretty obvious. The headline on the front page was "Schoolgirls Gone Wild." Shocking video, exclusive playground brawls out of control. I'll actually turn to the middle, to the editorial that that covers this particular subject. It's under the heading "Girl Power Goes Wrong." This was the editorial in yesterday's Daily Telegraph, and it is written: "Social commentators sometimes lament our acceptance of violence in the community. In fact, it's often said that we have become desensitized to violence. This may be overstating things, but anyone who watches the graphic video of schoolgirl violence on the Daily Telegraph's website today is guaranteed to be shocked. It is one of the most alarming and distressing pieces of footage you can ever imagine emerging from one of our schools. Bear in mind that the attack was over an argument the previous day about a basketball. Teenagers are known to overreact, but the disproportionate force here is out of control. So too evidently is general female violence in our schools. The solitary, terrifying incident captured on phone camera by students encouraging that fight is but one of many similar assaults over the past 5 years. During that time, the number of reported incidents of physical attacks involving girls has increased by more than 70%. This presents an urgent but unusual challenge for teachers. The level of female violence is new and daunting. Countering it may require different methods to countering male violence. As well, there is a technological aspect to this violence which deserves further attention. Children using their ubiquitous mobile phones to photograph such attacks should be aware that they could be charged by police for failing to render assistance. If teenagers are immune to the violence happening right in front of them, perhaps the threat of a police record might wake them up." That's the editorial. So it would appear, you can glean from that the number of violent incidents reported by schoolgirls has increased by 70%. Figures showing attacks involving girls have risen by 147% a year since 2005, while male violence remains stable. Last year, 154 violent incidents involving female students were reported to police. So it appears that violence in the community, I mean, all of this, you know, violence against women campaign and stuff, I mean, what is it? Is it backfiring? Is it having the opposite effect? Is it causing women to be more violent? I mean, what's the cause of all of this? There would be a number of causes. I mean, firstly, 50 years ago, nobody had a mobile phone that they could film incidents like this and then whack them up on Facebook so that the whole world could see. This is new, that we are actually able to take these incidents of shocking violence, which I'm sure occurred in the past. past, and suddenly stick them up on television so everybody can look at them and go, shock, horror, ooh, ah, look at that, that's terrible. It is terrible. But is the violence increasing, or is just our ability to be aware of it, to report it and to film it, and to show it to other people, is that also is increasing? It would appear that violence in the community all around is increasing. I mean, bullying, there's lots of campaigns about bullying, but then you sort of think, well, surely bullying was always prevalent, and now it's just become something that that's got news coverage. I don't know, what came first, the chicken or the egg? You know, what's cause and what is effect? They say that, all the violence on television, the violent video games that children play, that these things lead to violence. But, I mean, you've also got to take into account the breakdown of families, the lack of male role models of biological fathers in the homes of a lot of these young girls, causes them to behave in a manner that is extremely unladylike, put it that way. They seem to be mimicking the behaviour of juvenile delinquent boys more than anything else, which is a huge worry. I mean, it's bad enough when boys are juvenile delinquents. We don't need girls jumping on the bandwagon and being violent and imitating behaviour which society is going out of its way to condemn. We've got all of these campaigns against violence, against domestic violence. And it would appear that we really now need a campaign to wake women up to the fact that their being violent is just as appalling, just as atrocious, just as unacceptable as any man being violent.
As we'll be talking about the impact of computer games later on, when we're talking to Maggie Hamilton about her new book, What's Happening to Our Boys, we'll be discussing the secret life of boys and the impact this is having. But yesterday afternoon I was watching the good old National Rugby League, and there was a game between the South Sydney Roosters and I've forgotten who they were playing. But
some other bunch of thugs doing ballet in the mud.
Yes, the thing that came to mind, though, was a huge advertisement in the middle of the chest of the South Sydney players, and initially it looked like it was the White Ribbon, and I thought maybe this was money being poured into the White Ribbon campaign, but speaking to some female friends later, they mentioned that actually it was a silver ribbon, and the silver ribbon is a fundraiser for ovarian cancer. Now, this is a very good thing to be raising money for this particular women's cancer, and it's treatment of this women's cancer, and it's good that the South Sydney Rugby League players are supporting it. I imagine this is a part of their blending in the community, but the significance that the women saw is that men perhaps have this feeling of guilt, and the rugby league players who don't have the best of reputation are out there promoting this women's cancer research. And one wonders if there might be a similar women's group that would be promoting perhaps prostate cancer or something that only relates to men. I think not. So I think this is one of the examples where there's a little bit of discrimination. It doesn't form part of the very discriminatory White Ribbon campaign, but if we're going to be promoting the silver ribbon ovarian cancer, wouldn't it be nice to think there might be some reciprocal work being done, for reciprocal fundraising being done for some of the men's groups that presently are completely unfunded. So just a thought there. Now, we will be hopefully crossing to Ken Thompson, who is raising money and raising awareness for the international parental abduction cause. And I've just come across another example here, which Ken may be aware of, but this is a story that's come out in May 2010. It relates to an abduction to New Zealand. It was a case where Brian Ormsby of New Zealand and Bianca Ormsby of New Zealand and Adam Thomas had a brief affair while Bianca was attending the University of Michigan. They had a daughter, Sydney, who was born in May of last year. Now, Bianca and Adam were never married, but they did have a temporary child custody order in place, and it provided for one of them to have their child, Sydney, 4 consecutive days, followed by the other parent having her 3 days, and then they'd switch around. So effectively there was equal custody pursuant to a temporary court order. On March 9, 2010, Bianca picked up the little girl as usual, but that was the last time Thomas saw his daughter. On April 11th, he received an email from Bianca saying, quote, she was in New Zealand and thought being there was best for Sydney. So there was no consultation with Adam Thomas. The child was gone. There was obviously some support given to Bianca to get the child. She had to get a passport. She had to get money to travel to New Zealand. And it may well be that her family has assisted her in doing this, which makes it almost like an international conspiracy. It's a case where, a very sad case, where it was before the family court. Adam Thomas had actually expressed concerns to the court as early as July 2009 that Bianca Ormsby might flee to New Zealand with their daughter Sydney. But nothing was done, the child's gone, and now he has this dreadful battle trying to see his daughter again. Just one more of these international parental abductions that are so difficult to deal with.
Yes, another nightmare. Horrible.
So, we'll be speaking to Ken Thompson later on to see what he's doing about these very difficult situations. I might just mention, too, on parental alienation, which has been a frequent topic in this program, one of the world experts is Dr. Richard Warshak, who has an excellent book out called Divorce Poison, and you can get that through Amazon or going to Dr. Richard Warshak's own website. The Warshak is spelled W-A-R-S-H-A-K, so I think if you type that into your browser, you'll come up with Dr. Richard Warshak. And he has recently released a DVD, which is intended to assist alienated child, parents and professionals working in the field. It's called Welcome Back, Pluto, Understanding, Preventing and Overcoming Parental Alienation. I haven't seen the DVD yet, but having read the book, I feel confident in recommending this DVD to anyone that is interested in the topic of parental alienation, which again is a major problem in our society. So, yes, that's a DVD from Dr. Richard Warshak. Well, we might just go to a break, and we'll be back with more in a minute.
In the name of drive so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress, 1300 853 437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air this first day of June 2010. Just following up from stories we've done in previous weeks, the groundbreaking report from Edith Cowan University on it's titled The Intimate Partner Abuse of Men. This report was launched last Wednesday, and it's very interesting, giving the real statistics on the rate of domestic violence, particularly against males, which is which has a dark figure. Very, very, it's oftentimes not reported and not taken seriously. And this study put out by Edith Cowan University does give the actual gives the actual figures and is a genuine report on the incidence of this intimate partner abuse of men. So I commend it to you. You can go to the 1 in 3 website, which we often mention, either words or figures, you will find more information on that report. Also, speaking of universities, there's recently been an Aussie paper put out, which I'm sad to say totally misrepresents shared parenting. This is a study done by Dr. Alan Campbell of the University of South Australia, and I might add that the University of South Australia, unlike the Edith Cowan University, has a reputation for not supporting men's issues. Some of the other luminaries from that university have a particular reputation. But Dr. Alan Campbell has put out this study. His report seems to be saying that there were changes to the Family Law Act of Australia in 2006 that encouraged equally shared parenting. Dr. Campbell did a study of children inquiring to the effects of child parenting on child well-being, and concluded that the results tell us something about the new law. The results show that shared parenting is detrimental to children.
Well, where did he get that from?
Well, you might be surprised to learn that only the first of those is true, namely that there were changes to the Family Law of Australia in 2006.
That was true.
The study was actually a very small study. He interviewed 16 children between the ages of 7 and 17 whose parents were either divorced or separated. But the questions had nothing to do with shared parenting. The children interviewed for his study at most two and possibly none had parents in equally shared parenting relationships. Also, it was reported in 2008 about a study that had been done prior to that, and so in no way reflected anything about the changes to the Family Law Act enacted by the Howard government in 2006. His real findings were that parents and courts don't tend to ask children what they prefer. Children have opinions on what's right and fair. Children would like to be consulted about their desires, thoughts, ideas, etc. And children have a strong desire to be with both parents. Children think families can decide issues of custody better than court-appointed experts. So if you can see anything in those findings about shared parenting being detrimental to children...
Yeah, that really doesn't make sense at all. I would have thought from that he would have found that... Surely you would deduce from on what the children have to say that the children want to see both of their parents. That's probably their primary desire in a divorce situation, followed by wanting to see the cat or something. And if they can get to see both parents, then surely from the child's point of view, that's an optimum outcome.
Yes, well, if you'd like to see more on the particular study, it was in Adelaide Now on the 21st of May 2010. But if more importantly, if you'd like to see this study reviewed and perhaps get a lot more information in this topic, I'd recommend to you the Fathers and Families website. It's an American website, and Fathers and Families do a lot of good work in this area, they just happen to have come across this strange article from our own University of South Australia. So
yeah, I think we need some feminists in here to help us interpret that one. I don't think my mind is capable of performing the intellectual gymnastics required to reach that sort of conclusion from that sort of data.
No, extraordinary. Now, we'll also be following up with one of our previous guests, David Dufour, who's now back in the States. You might recall a couple of weeks back he was visiting Dads on the Air to get some material for his documentary film that he's putting together.
He shot us all.
He did, he did. And he'll be doing a study on maleness in 2010. And that's something to look out for. I think he's still getting more material, and then he's got to put it all together and then get it out there. So maybe later this year we'll be able to review that film and hopefully make it available. But in the meantime, we'll stay in touch with David and see how he's progressing on that project. Now, Phil, I think you've got a story there you'd like to mention.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Very tragic story. It's from today's Herald Sun, and I guess it just highlights the stress that parents go through when they're going through the separation process, family court, etc. The headline reads, "Dad will never recover from the Murupana death of his two sons," says devastated grandmother. The mother of two boys found dead in their bedroom remains under police guard in hospital this morning as a small town in northern Victoria mourns. The mother of the grieving dad says he will never recover from the loss of his two sons found dead in their bedroom. "I don't know how my son is going to cope," his inconsolable mother said. "They're my grandsons. They're my grandsons," she cried as she entered Goulburn Valley Base Hospital. Her son, Scott Robinson, was being treated for shock, and his estranged wife, Vanessa, 29, was being assessed under police guard. The death of the two brothers, which has stunned the small town, is believed to have come after a bitter separation. The alarm was raised after Mr. Robinson arrived at the well-kept home at about 6:30 on Sunday to find his children lifeless in the bedroom.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and it just goes on and on, and it is an absolute tragedy. You know, there's a photo of those two boys, and, you know, they're certainly the innocent ones in all this.
Absolutely, that's just a complete and utter tragedy. There's no white lining to that black cloud that you can't imagine at all. That's just a disaster, awful.
But, as I said, it just highlights the stress that parents can go through this separation process. It's stressful enough just trying to get through a process when both mum and dad are working together. But when they're not working together, it's just a whole different ball game. And, you know,
and people in the heat of the moment make really bad decisions. You know, both mothers and fathers have been guilty of this sort of really bad decision making. What else can you say?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and in the heat of the moment, and you don't think of the consequences, and you know, and people just do something just ridiculous that normally you would never consider doing, but you're just driven to such an emotional extreme through your experiences in the family court that you. You know, do stupid, ridiculous things like that under any normal, sane circumstance you would not consider doing.
Yeah, the whole system needs to be less adversarial.
Absolutely. Shocking. Well, I've got something here. This is, compared to that, this is actually on a happier note. The headline is $115 million on birth bungles, paying for negligence. Kate Sikora wrote in yesterday's Telegraph, "Medical negligence that has left babies with brain damage and mothers permanently scarred has cost the state government $115 million in compensation over the last 5 years. When families pursue legal action against hospitals, it sometimes takes years, with the settlements often occurring out of court but normally undisclosed. But documents obtained through Freedom of Information reveal the extent of the claims over negligence involving birth. And we can go into details here. In one tragic case, a woman died at Nepean Hospital after complications with a caesarean section delivery. It is unclear how much her family received in compensation, but the Sydney West Area Health Service, which runs Nepean, had the largest medical negligence bill totaling $34.5 million. So the doctors in the hospitals, they're understaffed, they're overstressed, they work too many hours, and this is what we get. We've got a health system that, you know, is killing children, is damaging babies that are being born and killing their mothers. Shocking.
Yes, well, the problems with the family court are not just limited to Australia. There's been another story from Ireland. And in Ireland, there's been a situation where a young Irish couple with a toddler have been left devastated after finding out that they are, in fact, half-brother and sister. And this is can be largely traced back to the involvement of the family court in Ireland. What happened was that the pair who grew up far apart and met 2 years ago have just recently had DNA testing to confirm that they share the same father. The young man, who is known only as James in this story, was unable to find out the truth about his family background because of secrecy surrounding Irish family law. So the couple in their 20s are now planning to undertake a landmark civil case against the judge and a child psychologist who are involved in James's case. They want to keep it secret for the sake of their son. But you can imagine when they first got that call about the DNA tests. The situation was that the couple's father, who's known as Tom, had unknowingly fathered James in a short-term relationship before he settled down with his current family. Once he found out about James' birth, about 4 years later, he proceeded with a legal battle to gain access to his son. But the court ruled that James should have no knowledge of his real father or have any access to him. And this is the unfortunate result that
he's marrying his half-sister.
Correct. They grew up in separate towns, about 100 miles, 160 kilometres apart, and they met by chance. But they immediately got on, developed a relationship.
And they had a lot in common, half their chromosomes.
Yep. Now they're in this dreadful situation. And they're hoping that by speaking out that this might help others in similar situation. The comment from James was that people hearing about this might think that the situation is a one-off and that the chances of this happening are the same as the chances of winning the lottery. Maybe they are, but let's face it, every week someone wins the lottery. And this is traced back very directly to the secrecy that surrounds the family court, not just in Australia, but as we've just heard, in Ireland.
Well, I've said it before, yes, it's, you know, the family court, these decisions, I mean, they don't think them through, you know, they've got a case at hand and they're just trying to clean up the mess and the spillage from a horrible emotional mess that's going on in front of them, and the consequences down the track, you know, 15, 20 years later, well, you know, they don't consider them, they don't consider the possible spin-off effects of what their judgments might produce in the future. And this is just one example of some of a hideous decision for this young couple who are obviously in love and looking, you know, they've got one child between them and are looking at having more. I mean, the genetic complications involved in you know, having children with your sister or your half-sister are well documented. Their future just doesn't look great at all. And of course, the stigma involved in being married to your sister, your half-sister, I mean, what a nightmare scenario that the family court completely failed to appreciate and have opened the door, basically, so that this sort of incident can occur with the frequency of winning lotto, which, as the guy said, happens once a week.
That's a battle. Just another story here. We've got a situation in the US. Now, this is a strange one, where a woman has been busily marrying servicemen. She's now up to 11 servicemen. And what she does is she marries them so that she can steal their life savings. Meanwhile, she's reportedly had 9 children by these men that she's duped, with many of the soldiers unaware that they even have a child. She's used at least 19 aliases as well as several different social security numbers to help get away with the scam. And what she does is she allegedly targets lonely soldiers at army bases who are about to be deployed overseas. She tells the men she's a daughter of a high-ranking general and that she can only claim her substantial inheritance once she gets married. This sounds something like the Nigerian scam, doesn't it?
Yeah.
After a whirlwind courtship, the con artist presses the men to get married. They get married, and then when the man is overseas on deployment, this woman runs up a monster credit card debt, writes false checks, and then flees town. One of the men, Shane Cheeseman, told US television he was devastated after learning that this woman, Finley, had conned him. He said, I got married on a Monday, and the following weekend she was gone. The police are sure that that the woman changes her surname regularly to avoid capture. She was last seen in July last year when she was arrested for making a false statement to police. So we can only hope for the good of the American Army that someone actually catches up with this woman and stops her.
Yeah, closes her down.
Yeah, getting away with it.
Basically, that's turning marriage into a business in a ridiculous way.
Okay, well, we might go to a break and we'll be back in a moment.
I'm
grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you're ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, and we've just been listening to Psycho Schizo Babe from the Man Agony album by Horizon Shine. Particularly appropriate, I think, in view of that last story of that US woman who's been busily marrying soldiers and stealing their life savings.
Yes, servicing servicemen.
Yes.
And, at a price.
Yeah, at a huge price.
Yes. Now, while we looks like we may be having some more difficulties getting hold of Ken Thompson, who's doing that ride across Europe.
He's on his bike again.
He's on his bike, and he, I think it's probably about 2 in the morning or somewhere wherever he is, but in any event, if we don't get to talk to him, we might just give you some news about what he's doing and where he's up to and how you can follow Ken on his travels. He does have the blog that's available, and perhaps, Phil, you might have that address there.
Yes, thanks, Bill. If you'd like to follow Ken's progress, you can go to Find Andrew. Sorry, I'm just trying to get the right address here. Find Andrew Thompson, Europe2010.blogspot.com. That'll get you straight to Ken's blog, or if you just go to findandrew.com, you can follow the links from there. And seeing Ken's not here, Ken, I hope you're well. I know you will be listening to this program sometime within the next 24 hours. So a big hi, and I hope everything's going well for you. It's a shame that we've missed you again this week, but I'm going to read a little bit from your blogs, mate. Let's go here. 29 and 30 of May 2010. The past couple of days have been quite varied. The ride from Winchester to Salisbury was very hilly in parts, rising to about 158 metres above sea level before descending again, and then rising and descending into Salisbury Plains. It was a day marked by hills, strong headwinds and crosswinds, and a very busy highway that I unwittingly found myself on right on the eve of the UK's bank holiday long weekend. So, yeah, he's been caught in a lot of rain and some cold weather. He talks about staff and patrons in several pubs, guest houses and cafes in Winchester and Salisbury, and at several places in between have asked for Andrew's bumper stickers. The owner, as well as the assistant manager of the Gifford guest house in Winchester, and other members of staff all took bumper stickers. Andrew's website has now been linked to that guest house website as well.
Just for listeners, should realise that Ken Thompson's son Andrew is the child that has been abducted and last seen in Frankfurt, in Germany. That Ken is doing his best to raise awareness throughout the UK and Europe.
Yeah, so he is travelling via bicycle, right, starting from England and going right through all different sections of Europe, trying to raise awareness, and hopefully, you know, someone will see Ken and contact the relevant authorities if they know of Andrew's whereabouts. So, you know, let's just go back to his blog. There is a part where people can post notes for Ken, notes of encouragement. The latest one here is Ken was the Deputy Commissioner
to the New South Wales Fire Brigade. And this is from Greg Mullins, who is the Commissioner of the Fire Brigade here in New South Wales. And it says, good luck from all your firefighter mates from across Australia, Ken. You are sorely missed by the New South Wales Fire Brigade, and we are 100% behind you in your search for Andrew. Stay safe. Greg Mullins, the Commissioner.
Well, wouldn't that be good for society if Ken could find Andrew? He could go back to his job as Deputy Commissioner and continue the great work he was doing in his career in the fire service. Up to now, his highest priority is trying to find his child, Andrew, trying to protect Andrew, who no doubt is in a... most likely, you'd have to think he's in a very dangerous situation. Apart from the obvious psychological damage, he may well be in any other type of damage, and we just hope that that Ken can make contact with Andrew as soon as possible.
Indeed. So, good luck, Ken, and we hope to hear from you very shortly, mate.
Yes, we'll try and get a message through to Ken during the week, and we'll be hoping to hear from him in next week's show. We had hoped to hear from him today, but anyway, that's the news from... We'll certainly be passing on the news from Ken every week in any event. And where did you say that Ken is right now, Phil?
He's in a place called... Let's just get this here. I think it was Little
Hampton.
Little Hampton, that's it.
And that's on the south coast of England, I think.
Yes, yes.
So he's still in the UK. Will shortly be heading across the European version of the ditch, across the Channel, and be continuing his travels throughout Europe. So we can only hope that someone sees something relevant and gets in touch with the authorities, and we can get those two back together. Okay, we might go to another break, and we'll be back shortly.
I do anything to prove. when he calls me Dad. Yeah, he calls me Dad. I haven't always been a single man.
Welcome back to Dad's on the Air this first day of June 2010. There's got an interesting story here about the birds and the bees via the fertility clinic. And this is a distinction being made in the United States between adopting and procuring sperm or eggs. And there's a completely different approach to it.
Adopting sperm as opposed to procuring it.
Well, you can go straight to adopting the child. That's one way of progressing. Or if you don't do that, yes, you go right back to procuring sperm or eggs. But if you want to adopt a child in the United States, you'll face an array of bureaucratic roadblocks and invasive interrogations. The adoption agencies will assess your finances, your relationships, your fitness as a potential guardian. Seems like you have to be a virtual saint to get through that process and actually adopt a child. While the interests of the child, not the desires of the would-be parent, will be treated as paramount throughout, of course. But different story if you go back to the base and just merely procure either a sperm donor or eggs, then you can shop for what you want the way you go shopping for a house or a car. You can buy ova from an Ivy League undergraduate, or you can buy your sperm from a 6'8" athletic blue-eyed Dane if you choose. The person selling you the right to bear and rear their biological offspring can do so anonymously with no future strings attached at all. So the result is a freewheeling fertility marketplace whose impact on American life keeps increasing. Sperm donations generate between 30,000 and 60,000 conceptions every year, and roughly 6,000 children are conceived through egg donation annually as well. So about 1 million American adults, if not more, are the biological children of sperm donors. Now this has this does have implications. The children, when they come to know that they are the circumstances of their conception, it does have some effect on them growing up, and for that reason, despite their reputation for permissiveness, many European nations have done much more than the supposedly socially conservative America to recognise that children as well as adults have an interest in the way assisted reproduction works. You'll find that in Britain, Sweden, Norway and Switzerland, anonymous sperm and egg donation is actually banned, and donor-conceived children have access to their family histories once they turn 18. Also, many countries have limited the number of children a sperm donor can father to well below the 25 that the American Medical Association recommends. Such restrictions would reduce the pool of willing donors and create longer waiting times and greater emotional anguish for aspiring parents. But they would also untangle some of the webs of secrecy and uncertainty that donor children find themselves born into, and they might diminish, if not completely undo, what one grown-up donor baby quoted in the study describes as the feeling of existing entirely for other people's purposes and not my own. So, yeah, it seems America might be going down the wrong track on their the birds and bees. In
scenario, another way they're going down the wrong track.
That's right.
We've got a lot of wrong tracks over there. I wonder what happened to the right track.
Yeah, now, Ian, you've got another story for us.
Oh, well, this is serious wrong track stuff. Yeah, this is almost too sad to bother with, but special investigation. This morning's Telegraph headline on the front page, score a fake ID for $80 and you can't spot the difference is what it says on the front page. Just $80 buys a license to binge. Mark Murray and Gemma Jones have written this exclusive article, which appears on page 4 of this morning's Telegraph. An underground trade run by teenagers is supplying underage drinkers with sophisticated fake proof of age licenses, contributing to almost 5,000 young people being fined for alcohol-related offences. A schoolboy and $80 is all that you need to get a new license with the date of birth changed. Teens use fake identity to fool doormen and staff at pubs, clubs and bottle shops. Only a license check on the police computer system will reveal details that have been changed. The article goes on to say, in the past 3 years, there were 4,679 fines issued for offences ranging from a person under the age of 18 drinking in public to teens using fake IDs to buy alcohol or to get into pubs. Police caught 231 teenagers in the Sydney Central Business District, including 72 teens caught using fake IDs to buy alcohol from bottle shops and licensed premises. It goes on to say, my friends and I do 15 to 20 licenses a week, said Brad, a 17-year-old Eastern Suburbs schoolboy. There are four of us and we bought a special machine for about $2,500. Everyone who comes to me wants a fake ID so they can get into pubs, clubs and buy booze from bottle shops. Most kids I know have them, he said. So there we are. So all of this, if they're easy to fake driver's license and kids are getting a hold of them, and I mean binge drinking and is a serious problem in the community. I mean it's serious for these young kids with growing brains. Alcohol does a lot of damage to a growing brain. It does a lot of damage to a growing brain, but even more to a growing brain. And young children under the age of 18 should be discouraged in every possible way from, well, too much too young, you know. If you want to drink, sure, start when you're in your 20s, when your body can handle it, when you're mature enough, you're emotionally, physically mature enough to be able to handle it a little bit better. But, I mean, alcohol is an incredibly dangerous poison. If you walk into a bottle shop, there is enough alcohol on the shelves to kill 50 or 60 people, it is a dangerous poison, no matter how you look at it. If an 18-year-old kid was to scull two bottles of scotch or vodka or something, that would kill them. It's enough poison in there to kill them. And, the way we glamorize alcohol in our society, what are these kids supposed to think? I mean, as a parent, I know I love to get home from a hard day's work and open a beer and sit down in front of television, and that's just part of our culture and our society here. But the impact on children who are wanting to do more younger, and now they're empowering themselves with fake driver's licenses to go and procure their own alcohol. And I actually had an incident in the street last night. I was walking down the road in Kingsford in Sydney here in the eastern suburbs, and a young guy came up to me and said, could you buy me some alcohol? And I mean, I don't know how old he was. He didn't look that young, you know, maybe 15 or 16 or something. And I just shook my head and kept walking.
If Ian looks like a suitable person to ask for.
All the things to ask me for. But anyway, he didn't get his alcohol, and I just thought, he obviously didn't have a fake ID. I should have referred him to some schoolboy, asked him if he had $80, and he could have gone and bought himself a fake ID, and he could have gone and got me some alcohol.
I think a lot of these come back to, unfortunately, the impact of broken families too, that where the child's not getting that the input from both parents, that you get into these situations, these unfortunate situations.
Yes. No, the old devil and the elephant in the room, yes, broken families, you know, are the reason behind most of these social evils that we plough through here every week on Dad's on the Air. This is our bread and butter. I mean, it's not a happy duty. We are chronicling a society, a civilization that is unravelling. As the nuclear family is dissolved, it becomes a meaningless ideal. The marriage contract is now pretty much meaningless. It means nothing. It's like, oh, well, you know, you need more of a contract pretty much to meet a girl and take her home from the pub to go to bed with her than you need for a marriage contract these days. And, of course, yeah, the symptoms are showing in our children. And this is just one thing. They're drinking more. They're taking more drugs. More of them are ending up in jail. And it's a shocking mess. It's a terrible state of affairs.
Okay, look, we hope to be back soon speaking with Maggie Hamilton, and in the meantime we'll go to a break.
Meeting your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
Welcome back to Dads on the Air, and we're very pleased to have as our special guest this morning Maggie Hamilton. Maggie has recently put out a book called What's Happening to Our Boys, a follow-up on a book called What's Happening to Our Girls. Maggie conducts courses, lectures and workshops throughout Australia and New Zealand, and her books are available in Australia, New Zealand and South Africa. You can order these from Better Read Than Dead Bookshop Secure Server. So it's a great pleasure to have you on the show. Are you there, Maggie?
Yes, lovely to be with you again.
Yes, we always enjoy having you on the show. And
me too, with you guys.
I mean, we really appreciate you taking some time out, because I'm sure you're very busy with these various launches. I know I'm going to one, I think, tomorrow night, and then you've got North Sydney Library on Thursday, I think.
Yeah, it is busy. And what's really nice is that, you know, there's a lot of interest about our boys, which is, it's long overdue, so I'm thrilled.
Well, that's great. Well, we certainly want to encourage that, because, yes, I think they're suffering at school, they're suffering in, you know, compared to years ago, and I think we certainly need to help them as much as we can.
We do, and I think with our boys, they've almost got like two layers of issues to deal with. I think, first of all, before all the 21st century pressures hit, there were so many things that we hadn't still got right for our boys in terms of that early nurture and care and nourishment that every child needs before we expect boys to be strong and independent, giving them the opportunity to be emotionally expressive and to realize that's part of strength. I think there's still a lot to be done there. The kind of narrow role models that boys have, and also those horrible narratives that our boys hear all the time of jokes around men and boys, you know, every man and boy is stupid or dangerous, which are really, really destructive to our boys. And then you add on all the 21st century stuff, and it's a lot for young kids to cope with.
Yes, I mean, it's very easy to look at some of the advertising where men are portrayed in very, very unfortunate roles, where they're portrayed as stupid or violent or anything else in between. But I suppose I saw the article about the book in the Sunday Life section of the Sun Herald, and in that you were talking about the secret lives that boys are being forced to go into, I suppose, with all that other around them.
That's right. And I think kids have always had secret lives, and it's really important, because that is part of growing that sense of self and kind of, you know, thinking about who you are and kind of exploring that in a private way. I think what is worrying now with the new technologies and with this really dysfunctional popular culture that we have is that boys are kind of encouraged to do that in a way that is really destructive for them. So it's not actually growing their sense of self. It's not empowering them, making them feel good. It's quite the opposite. It's making them feel more anxious, getting them into more risky behaviour. And so it's actually undercutting what our boys should be dealing with as they grow, and certainly not any preparation for adult life.
No, and it seems to be becoming, well, much more of a problem, isn't it, that that boys are perhaps more inclined to go and play Facebook or play computer games rather than get out and actually enjoy themselves in a social situation.
And yeah, absolutely. And I think this is one of the really tragic things for our boys. And I just feel so sad about it often, because, you know, I think one of the great things about young boys, and it's not every young boy I know, but, you know, they are so physical, they are so full of life, and yet we've become so worried about pedophiles and terrorists and every other kind of apparently fearful thing lurking around each corner that our kids are becoming like little battery hens. And so that opportunity to be physical is just so narrow now, and of course gets focused into things like the video games. But the other thing is that, you know, we tend to see boys as a nuisance. So, you know, we see kids skateboarding in a local area, and often it's not the most ideal location in terms of the general public, but it's often the only place they can skateboard. And all we can go on about is how inconvenient it is for us, and we don't stop to think for a minute, well, if we were able to provide something in a local public place for boys, that actually it's a really good, positive, physical thing for them to be doing, and it enables them to have some risk-taking, there's the skill levels required, etc. All those things are really positive, but instead all we can think about is how inconvenient. So yet again, we kind of push our boys into the fringes, I feel.
Yes, are these the issues you've been exploring in this in your new book, What's Happening to Our Boys?
Absolutely, yeah. And what I do is I start at birth because of the incredible marketing to our small kids now. And this is really going to bite with our boys in the next few years, and we're seeing it already because the advertisers and the corporations have realised that boys are the only demographic that they really haven't got a strong hold of. And so if you look at the big entertainment industries like Disney and others, they are pouring millions into marketing products to boys now and new programs that are going to come online. The fashion houses, a lot of product which was kind of either adult male clothing or teen and adult clothing are now being pushed into the very small boys, you know, so everything from Ralph Lauren kind of clothing down to the more edgy clothing like Billabong and Rip Curl, so that they can get these boys very young. And what we're now seeing, which we've never seen before, is a huge growth in anxiety around presentation and possessions, even at preschool.
Mm.
So I kind of follow that journey with the boys. And there's heaps of solutions in the book as well. Look also at the kind of stuff we hadn't dealt with before these issues, the 21st issues, took hold, and into the tweens, the 6 to 12-year-olds, and then the focus of the book is mainly the teenagers, but it was really important to look at what's happening for little boys and for our primary school boys as well.
Yeah, so that's the background for it. And you've previously written about what's happened to our girls, I think.
Yeah.
What do you see as the differences between the what's happened to the boys and what's happened to the girls?
I think that the difference overall is that I think as parents and as adults, we are always much more alert to the fact that girls are vulnerable in a whole range of areas. Mm. And so if we take the sexual climate, for instance, you know, we're very concerned, and rightly so, about some of the stuff that girls are subjected to, not to mention the kind of things they're getting up to. But we don't stop for a minute to think what it's like to be a young boy growing up in this hyper-sexualized kind of world with often very, very sexy advertising, MTV clips that are almost semi-pornographic, what it's like to be a boy of 11 who receives texts on his mobile phone of girls sending photos of themselves semi-clothed or not clothed or, you know, inappropriate messages, and what it's like to have the pressure from peers to behaving in certain ways sexually, and how vulnerable that makes a boy as he comes into his own understanding as a sexual person. Including, of course, the fact that, you know, if he's found with an image on his phone, you know, he can be charged for the possession of child pornography, et cetera, et cetera. So I think these are things that we have to be able to really take a close look at as parents. And I think this is where dads have a huge role to play as gatekeepers because, you know, boys, they're the bridge to manhood, or they should be, the good and the other good men that surround a boy, as well, of course, as the roles that mums can play. But I think that dads have taken a back seat for too long, and I think society hasn't encouraged fathers enough to play a really central role in the lives of boys.
Well, it's very interesting hearing you as a woman saying that and being aware of that situation. Where did you in coming up with the your book? Did you were you accessing research that's being done around the world?
Yeah, what I basically did, which is kind of the same path I took for the girls, is that I interviewed a whole lot of boys across the country, right across, you know, the socioeconomic spectrum, kids who are living in the city, who are living in rural areas, and then talked to teachers, school counsellors, child psychologists, people who work in emergency departments, police, people working underground on the net, and then experts in different fields, whether it's eating issues and all the many other topics I go into in the book, looking at their popular culture and the stuff they're immersing themselves in and the marketing, and also looking at research around all those topics locally and internationally, and putting that all together in I hope, a very, very readable way for parents, so that, what I wanted to do was to create an intimate sense of what it's like to be inside a boy's skin today in the 21st century, as well as parents being able to see kind of themes and influences on their kids, which is another reason why I started with them very little, because that's where a lot of the problematic influences are starting now.
Yes, and did you find a common theme with the boys from the country and the boys from the city?
Absolutely. I mean, you'd think that kids who live in rural areas would have quite a different take on things, but they're all accessing the same popular culture, which is really like the super parent now. So it's alarming just how similar their aspirations are, their values, what they're focused on, just how similar it is regardless of who they are and where they're living.
Yes, and I wanted to come back to you then about what parents can do, but it seems to be generally, I think there's a fear of parents to parent, isn't it? They just seem to be so influenced. They're influenced by all these extraneous sources as well.
I think it's really hard to be a parent now. I think there's no doubt about it. I think things have changed so quickly. It's hard to get a take on what's happening, and hopefully the book will really help bring people up to speed. But it's more than that. I think the weight of marketing and the desperate feeling parents often have around the cool factor, you know, if I say no to this, it makes me look like I'm a parent from 1950s. And what we often don't realise is the parents down the road and across the road are going through the same dilemmas. And so everybody ends up caving in because they just don't want to look, you know, like they're not where it's at. And whereas, you know, it's almost like we're forgetting what's best for the children. These pressures come with, you know, big money advertising campaigns behind them.
Yes, I mean, I sometimes compare it with, say, a coach of a football team, but where some coaches think they've got to be one of the boys and others think they've got to be extreme disciplinarians, and then you get the others who have a mix. And I think the parents can sometimes fall into that same trap, that if they want to be like one of the kids, you know, like this is my sister rather than my daughter, they can...
And it's not good.
It's not good for either of them.
And kids don't need a 40-year-old best friend.
No, that's
They've
right.
They've got plenty of best friends. And you're absolutely right. The authoritarian thing also does not work with 21st century kids. And this is not, I'm not saying that we go easy in areas that we shouldn't, but this is an information generation. You know, when a lot of us were growing up, we relied on our parents, we relied on teachers for information. If we didn't get that, you could kind of wander off to the local library but you couldn't ask a librarian about what you were probably wanting to know about. And so 9 times out of 10, you wouldn't find it, so you'd get on with your childhood. Now it's a click of a mouse away to find that information. So we need to approach all these topics much earlier, but also in a discussion way. The kids love to be kind of included. You know, what do you think about it? How would that person have felt, do you think, when that happened? Was that a good thing? What perhaps should they have done? So that they actually, you kind of herd them round to the right conclusion they should come to. And, you know, still talking boundaries and consequences. Because this new generation is very immature and has a much narrower life experience. So it's really important we have that kind of culture in the home where stuff is discussed, and not just once, but as an ongoing thing, so that they really get the nuance of what's happening here and why it's a bad idea and what happens, you know, when kids do cross often these very fuzzy lines that we have at the moment in terms of what's a good idea and what's not.
Yes. I'd like to come back to you on some very practical steps that you've outlined that parents can do. Would you be able to stay on the line for a moment, Maggie, and we'll just go have a short break? We'll be back to you in a moment. We're speaking with Maggie Hamilton, the author of a new book called What's Happening to Our Boys.
I first heard my voice.
Back to Dad's on the Air, and we're speaking with Maggie Hamilton, the author of What's Happening to Our Boys. Now, Maggie, we've talked about the problems that the young boys are facing.
Yeah.
What, on the other side of the coin, I mean, what can the parents do? And I suppose one that springs to mind might be to stay together is probably one of the best things you could do for your parents, isn't it, for your boys?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that's really saddening in recent years is that we really are not understanding the full impact of boys growing up without good men around them. And also, I think women have been trying too hard to do stuff themselves, and it's a very lonely and hard path, I think, when you're trying to be father and mother and everything else as well. And what's interesting to me is, in talking to the boys, was just how important each parent is. You know, if we take the mums, for instance, the boys would talk about how, they love being around mum, for talking about often the kind of very tender stuff, and that mums will talk at length about this kind of thing. Not that dads won't ever, but it tended to be mum they go to for those things, and how much they loved her food, that was such a form of nourishment. I mean, obviously they weren't using those words, but, food is nourishment, and it's not just nourishment of the body, it kind of nourishes the spirit as well. When we look at dads, we know developmentally that from being very little, dads have a very special role to play, that even the way they play with small children is really important for child's development, so that whereas a mum will be very often contained in the way she plays with a child and very safe often when they're very little, and dads are chucking them around and it's all getting quite wild, that actually is really important for children, to actually show them there's actually a world beyond that safe space they're in with mum. And then when it gets too much, they scream or they cry, and we know that's the end of that. They've had enough of that. But they love playing with dad with these games, because it actually is often very spontaneous play and different every time. As the boys grow, what was really interesting was how often the boys said how sad they felt if dad wasn't around. Even dads who were away for work a lot, and the boys used words like sad, because it's that needing that male input. And, and when you've got the mum and the dad, then it's a very, very powerful thing for boys. And they really get that. And talked often how sad they were for friends who didn't necessarily have that backup.
Yes, I mean, one of the things that perhaps dads can do is have those ongoing discussions about boundaries and what's appropriate, what's not appropriate.
And boys, sorry to interrupt, I think they often get it also almost by osmosis. When I've gone into school to talk to boys about my previous book on men and boys, What Men Don't Talk About, and I actually say to the boys, you know, that testosterone's a beautiful thing, and they just look gobsmacked when it's used, you know, properly, and I'd say how powerful it is to see, you know, a young fireman, older fireman for that matter, running out of a burning building with a small child. Mm. Not that men necessarily need to be putting their lives on the line, but, you know, how heroic that is. And but then we talk about what happens when they get in the car, and, you know, if they're driving along with more than one mate, does that make them more or less safe on the road? And, of course, they know the answers to that and why. And then I say to them, okay, so, you know, you're taking out a girl, you know, for the first time, and you're going to drive around to her place and pick her up, and you meet her dad at the door. You know, so what's your driving like then? And they all go, oh, you know, we're a whole lot safer. And I say, why is that? I mean, obviously I know the answer. Oh, because we met her dad, and we're going, oh, and I say, you're going to drop her home. And, you know, her dad might be there when we drop her home. Just that meeting of that male influence is very focusing and very, very powerful. And then we all have a bit of a laugh about it in the classroom. But, you know, but in a good way, that, you know, there are certain things that can focus us actually to be taking care of ourselves and other people, and that dad's a great way of doing that. Even though that dad may never say anything to that boy about driving safe, the fact that he gives that guy a good strong handshake is enough. And this is what it's all about. I think it's also that thing of, you know, just hanging out with dad, that one-on-one time. There's a fantastic organisation in New Zealand that I don't know whether you know about. I only found about it when I was doing research for the book called Big Buddy. And it's for boys 8 to 12 who don't have a dad in their lives for whatever reason. And these are older blokes who kind of put up their hand to mentor younger boys. But it's not a structured program of, you know, having to do X, Y, or Z. It's hanging out, it's going fishing, it's helping men bikes. You know, it's just chilling out together. And it's extraordinarily powerful. And one of the people I spoke to who runs it was telling me several quite moving stories, but they were telling me about one boy whose dad had hung himself when the boy was 8, and his mother didn't tell him what had happened to his father then, because she didn't think he was ready for it. Anyway, he got a mentor and used to love going off doing all sorts of things. And then when the boy was 12, the mother decided it was time for him to be told. So they did a bit of counselling around that beforehand with the help of the Big Buddy people. And so when she finally sat down and told her son, he put his arm around his mum and he said, you know, you're not to worry, Mum. He said, because I've got my mentor and you've got me and we're going to be okay.
Oh, that's a wonderful story.
And this is the sort of thing we're talking about, the power of that male presence. Mm. And, you know, brilliant to talk to the people who are running this program, and this is what all our kids need. We need, and I think this is what our girls need. They need the strength of dads and good men around them, you know, and also for us to listen to what men say about stuff like, you know, if you're going to go out dressed like this, then this is what the signals you are sending. It's not that you're asking to be raped, but you are putting out messages that are not a good idea. And we have to be big enough and grown up enough to listen to what you have to say to tell us that is really, really important for our girls as well as our boys.
Yes, look, I couldn't agree with you any more. It'd be impossible to agree with you more, Maggie, but those are sort of the big issues. Just some of the smaller ones, I notice you've recommended that the parents, for instance, stay well informed about new technologies so they can
absolutely
interact.
Yep.
And that, I mean, one that I've always been keen on is that computers should be in a public place in the house. So that, they're not, I mean, I've heard many cases where the children go off to their rooms, lock the door and, you know, spend hours on the computer, and I think that's very dangerous.
It is very dangerous, and it also creates this thing where, you know, the home's like a hotel. Yeah. It's not like a place where people's lives are intersecting. And I think the kitchen table culture is really important, sitting down, having meals together, telly off, and just downloading the day. Not just, you know, difficult stuff that's happened, but funny and mad stuff. You know, you can almost have a psychodrama going on around the table where you act out stuff. I think also it's about it's about creating friendships across the generation. This generation is largely mixes with peers, and that's unhelpful because it's the blind leading the blind. Of course, they've got to have their friends, but when they've got good adult friends around, you know, from different backgrounds with different stories, different experience, different encouragements, that's very nourishing for kids.
Yes, Maggie, look, unfortunately, we could talk about this for hours, I'm sure, but we've run out of time. Just wanted to thank you again for coming on the show, Maggie Hamilton, the author of What's Happening to Our Boys. So look out for that. It's published by Viking. And Maggie, thank you again. And
great pleasure.
Dad's on the Air. We'll be back next week with another show, and we'll look forward to talking to everyone then. Don't forget, you can hear this show again on www.dadsontheair.net, and stay tuned for Country On with Country Bob.
We're dead.